Well, we didn't get to slide 8 yet. We haven't mentioned it yet. But what we're seeing here is the fairly complex way in which iron is dealt with as it enters the body. Now, what's the big deal about iron? Well, that's a little general. Right. Iron is a component of the heme group. How many of those are on a hemoglobin molecule? 4, which is why a single hemoglobin molecule can carry up to 4 oxygen molecules. So we need a lot of it because there's a lot of hemoglobin in every single red blood cell, and there's a hell of a lot of red blood cells in, 5 million typically red blood cells in a microliter, which is a millimeter by a millimeter by a millimeter. That's not very much blood. So in the whole body, there is a tremendous amount of hemoglobin molecules, very many pentillions, and they all require iron. So iron is coming in the food, of course, and it enters the stomach, or it gets absorbed, it gets ingested as food in the form either of ferric or iron 3 ions, or as ferrous or iron 2 ions. So iron is one of those transition elements that can form multiple kinds of ions. So iron 3, ferric ions, ion 2, ferrous ions, there's a mixture of both of them in the food as they come into the stomach. But whatever ferric ions or iron 3 ions there are get converted into ferrous ions by the stomach acid. So it essentially will all become iron 2, Fe2 plus. Now that iron 2 ion needs to be conjugated to a protein in order to be carried around in the body. And cells of the stomach produce the first protein in this kind of complex process called gastroferritin. Gastro meaning stomach, and ferritin referring to a iron-carrying protein. Ferro is always going to mean iron, and that's why iron's symbol is Fe. So once the iron 2 ions bind to gastroferritin, it will eventually, of course, like all things in the stomach, leave toward the small intestine. And that's when gastroferritin, which is just a temporary taxi for this iron 2 ion, will give it up, give it meaning the iron 2 ion, and give it up to the blood via a capillary, a nearby capillary. Within the blood is a different protein called transferrin. Not because of transfer. I mean, not only because of that. The fair part of transferrin is once again referring to iron. Transferrin picks up the ferrous ions that gastroferritin handed off to it. And so now in the bloodstream, the iron is moving around conjugated to transferrin. Eventually, of course, we'll get where all blood goes, eventually to the liver that we see here, and release the transferrin will release the ferrous ions to the liver cells themselves, where it will be conjugated to a third protein that's produced in the liver called ferritin, but it's actually not called ferritin until it's actually picked up the iron. So it's produced as apoferritin. This apo, meaning separated from, is, you see this in other uses of things that are two-part. For instance, an apoenzyme is not yet ready to be an enzyme. It's just the protein. Some enzymes have to have something else stuck onto them, which is what a lot of vitamins do, for instance. Once that vitamin or metal ion, whatever it is, that cofactor that needs to bind to the enzyme gets bound to it. Then we call it a holoenzyme, but it's an apoenzyme before that. Similarly, you have apoferritin, but once the iron gets stuck onto that, then it's ferritin. Now, iron gets stored somewhat by the liver, so there is a somewhat of a storage of iron in the body to be used later. But what? But after it's released by the liver into the bloodstream again, then it's going to go chiefly to the marrow, right, which is where red blood cells are made. So to make the hemoglobin that fills the brand new red blood cells as they're being created, the erythrocytes, that's the major use of the iron. Okay, well, myoglobin as well. Hemoglobin, of course, has iron, but so does myoglobin. And what's the difference? Have you heard of myoglobin? What does myo mean? Myo means muscle. Myography is measuring muscles. Anyway, they're both oxygen-binding pigments, hemoglobin and myoglobin. The difference, a couple major differences. One is that hemoglobin is in the red blood cells. Myoglobin is in the muscle cells. But the other major difference is hemoglobin can carry up to 4 because it has 4 hemes. Myoglobin can carry 1 or 0. But they work for the same reason, to carry oxygen.
When the transferrin brings it to the liver, does all of it go into the liver and then back out into the bloodstream, or only some of it?
No, some of it, and these black arrows are saying some of this is going to be brought into the liver for storage.
Okay.
Some of it just flows through.
Okay.
And then also some of that stored iron can be released by the liver into the bloodstream if needed. All right, let's go to 9. Here we have a negative feedback mechanism working. The red blood cell count, the hematocrit that we talked about earlier, is adjustable based on the needs of the body. So in this case, at the top, starting working around with the flow of the arrows, at the top we have an error. Remember that feedback mechanisms have errors associated, right? An error is any difference between what the set point is, in other words, the desired value, and what the real value is at the moment. If there is no difference, then there's no error, and there's therefore no need for adjustment. But if there's an error, there's a need for adjustment. In this case, the error is hypoxemia. Now, the emia part of that refers to blood. Hypo means below, and ox for oxygen. So hypoxemia is inadequate O2 transport. The cells of the body are not getting enough oxygen. And this isn't in the very short term, because, I mean, you can cause hypoxemia simply by holding your breath, right? Which is going to cause an adjustment in your ventilation, in your respiratory system, not necessarily producing more red blood cells right away. But prolonged hypoxemia, like, for instance, if you were to move up in elevation, to move to the top of a mountain, that you're going to have prolonged hypoxemia in that case, and or blood loss, for that matter. Anyway, whatever the cause of the hypoxemia is, the solution, of course, is to produce more red blood cells so that they can carry more oxygen to the body tissues. Well, this hypoxemia is sensed, as you see, by liver and kidneys. Chemically, they can sense the hypoxemia, and they respond, as we've already talked about, by secreting erythropoietin, or erythropoietin. And which one of these two organs secretes the more? Kidneys secrete more than the liver, but they both secrete it, and it doesn't matter where it comes from. It's identical chemically, and it has the same effect on the target tissues. Well, they secrete it, since it's a hormone, into the bloodstream, of course. So those hormone molecules of erythropoietin eventually reach cells that make up red marrow, which are mostly in the axial skeleton bones in an adult. The red bone marrow is red, like I said before, because most of the cells that, most of the blood cells that those hematopoietic cells are able to make are red blood cells. And they're the, in response to erythropoietin, the name of the hormone gives it away, right? The response is an increase in the process of erythropoiesis, formation of new blood cells, new red blood cells specifically. And so usually that will cure the problem. It depends actually on what the cause of hypoxia is, but a normal cause of hypoxia, for instance, not lung disease, if it's just because you're not getting enough because you have too few red blood cells, then making more will solve the problem. So that's classic negative feedback, because negative feedback negates the error, or at least reduces it. And so it brings it back toward the set point. Okay, now to 10. Another flow chart to follow here. This has to do with what happens to red blood cells or erythrocytes that have seen better days. We already talked about the fact that they're not very long-lived cells, right? Why is that mainly? Capillaries are small, which is rough on them mechanically, rough on the red blood cells. But why else? In other words, why don't they just fix themselves? Yeah, they don't have a nucleus. So they don't have any DNA, they don't have any idea how to make any proteins, and even if they did, they also don't have any ribosomes to translate the messenger RNA that would be made if they did have DNA. So they don't have any of the organeller machinery to produce new proteins, which is what would be required to replace ones that get worn out. That's really what happens. The proteins that they have, that they made before they lost their nucleus in their developmental process, those allow them to be springy and you know, get deformed as they go through these tight spaces in the capillaries. But that's, you know, you use a molecule over and over, and eventually it's going to break, basically. It's proteins in a normal cell, and normal meaning one that has a nucleus, are always being broken down. They don't last forever, and they're just replaced by going back to the drawing board, the library, the gene that is the instruction for how to make new ones of exactly the same type. Well, that can't happen in a red blood cell. So after just 120 days on average, of course it's not exactly 120 days, but somewhere around there, the average red blood cell will start to malfunction, basically. And to a certain degree in the liver, they will be broken down, but mostly in the spleen. And the spleen is kind of good for doing this, because within the spleen, which we'll look at later, there are very tight spaces, even tighter than the capillaries. So they really stress the ability of a red blood cell to endure that deformation. And ones that can't make the cut will just burst, basically. And when a red blood cell bursts, which is called hemolysis, you now have basically an empty bag made of membrane plus several million hemoglobin molecules to deal with. Well, the plasma membrane material, which is just phospholipids mostly, and some proteins that are embedded in it, those are fairly easily phagocytized. What does that mean? It means they undergo phagocytosis. But what is phagocytosis? Well, what kind of process is phagocytosis?
Mm-hmm.
It's vesicular transport, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But phagocytosis is called that because, what does the phago part of that word mean? Eat, right. So cells are at the ready to engulf the phospholipids and other debris from the plasma membrane itself. And that stuff's not wasted, of course. It's the organic molecules that all the stuff in cells are made of. So that gets recycled. The heme, on the other hand, is a little more complicated to deal with. The most valuable part from the viewpoint of the body of the heme is the iron. So as part of hemoglobin degradation, the heme, I skipped a step. The hemoglobin is protein and heme, right, together. The globin subunits are proteins. So they get separated from the heme, first of all. The globins are, like any other polypeptide, able to be broken down into individual amino acids, which is what they're made of to begin with. And so those amino acids are good for making whatever new protein the cell wants to make, based on transcription and translation. So the amino acids are just raw materials again. They can be immediately reused. The heme, on the other hand, then, what I was trying to say before is the most valuable part of the heme is the iron, and the rest of it, which is basically the waste part of just the heme of hemoglobin, goes through a multi-step transformation process. So macrophages that engulf the heme convert it first into something that's called biliverdin, which is kind of a greenish color, hence the name, verdin meaning green. That then gets converted into bilirubin, which is a more reddish color, hence its name. And the liver will take a little bit of most of the biliverdin gets converted into bilirubin, not all of it, but the liver will take both biliverdin and bilirubin and incorporate it into its secretory product. The liver is another example of an endocrine gland and an exocrine gland, right? It's also the biggest gland of the body. What is the exocrine product of the liver? No? Bile, right. Bile is produced by the liver through and released through ducts. That's why it's the exocrine product. The endocrine product of liver are the hormones that we've already talked about that it produces. So bile is being produced by the liver more or less continuously, and it has various things in it, which we'll talk about later because that's a digestive function of the liver. But in that mix of stuff that collectively is called bile is the biliverdin and mostly bilirubin that came from breaking down heme that came from old blood cells, hemoglobin. All right, and it's that bilirubin I should just finish about this bile. Even though we're not going to talk about what bile does specifically in the digestive system, it gets secreted. First of all, it gets stored temporarily in the bile, in the gallbladder, and then the gallbladder will be told periodically or intermittently to release the bile into the small intestine for digestive purposes. But since it contains this bilirubin, that means the bilirubin ends up in the gut. Okay? So technically outside the body, like I say. Anyway, the bilirubin, because of its color, is the main reason that we have the color of the feces. That's mostly from breakdown of heme. It's not from the food that you eat. Meanwhile, the iron, which is scavenged because it's valuable, because you only really absorb a little bit of the iron that's in your food. So it makes sense to save it, the stuff that's already in your body. Some of it gets stored, some of it gets reused, but some of it does get lost, especially by menstruation in women of menstrual age. Okay, now we'll go to 11 and talk about the ABO blood group. Now, first of all, there are hundreds of different blood groups in humans. Almost none of them are known at all by humans, except for humans that have a specific interest in blood groups for some reason. The only one, the ABO blood group is one of the only ones we really care about, because it's one of the only ones that can really cause problems or death if things aren't taken care of correctly in a clinical setting. So this is not the blood group. This is one of many, many blood groups. All right? There are two really that we care about, the ABO blood group and the RH group. And they are entirely independent of each other. Okay, so the ABO, within the ABO blood group, a person is either type A, type B, type O, or type AB. And that's it. That's the ABO blood group. But when you talk about a person's blood type, it will be something like A negative or AB positive. That's really just shorthand notation for the results of two independent blood groups. You're either positive or negative within the RH group, and that has nothing at all to do with what you are in the ABO group, which is either AB or AB. ABO or AB. Well, anyway, these blood groups have to do with antigens and antibodies. Now, antibodies are proteins. And what kind of proteins are they specifically? Anyone remember from 2 days ago? They're gamma globulins, remember. And they're, because they are involved in immunity, the process of immunity, or the protective function of immunity, they are called immunoglobulins. All right? Well, an antibody, which is a protein made by certain white blood cells, is able, because of its shape, to recognize the shape of something else. That something else, which is a specific thing. Each antibody can recognize a specific thing. That specific thing that an antibody or an immunoglobulin can recognize is called an antigen. That's the general word. Okay? Antigens get recognized by antibodies. Now, antigens are... Antibodies are in your body so that they can recognize antigens that should not be there. So antigens that your antibodies recognize under normal circumstances, if you're a normal person, your antibodies should recognize things that have no business being in your body and therefore raise a red flag. That's their immune function. Their antigens, in other words, are foreign material. Okay, well, all red blood cells within a person's body are the same, but the red blood cells from person to person are different, not because of the hemoglobin, that's the same. What's different from red blood cell of one type person to another type person is that the antigens that are on the surface of those red blood cells is different. So these antigens that we're talking about, there's all kinds of different antigens, but the antigens we care about for the ABO blood group are glycolipids. What is a glycolipid? It's a lipid that has a sugar stuck to it. Glyco meaning sugar. So glycolipids, the glyco or the sugar part of a glycolipid, or for that matter a glycoprotein, is used often by multicellular organisms as little identifying tags, basically. And that's what's happening with these red blood cells. The sugar part that's hanging off of the glycolipid, the lipid keeps it in the membrane. The sugar part is really the functional antigen that we're talking about. And different people make different kinds of these glycolipids, the antigens. which is determined by the genetics of the person. So, the ABO blood group gene has two possible, has three different alleles for it, three different versions of that gene. But any given person is carrying two genes. So there are two alleles that each person has, and that those two alleles are going to determine that person's type of glycolipids or antigens that that person makes on the surface of its red blood cells. All right. So the three possibilities are abbreviated I, small I, for immunoglobulin, with a superscript A, capital A. That's a type A allele. The other type is a type B allele, I super B. And then the third possibility is just I by itself. All right? The I super A allele, which is a gene, allows for that person to produce type A antigens. Okay? And B, type B antigens. The I by itself doesn't produce antigens. A person is going to have two alleles. And therefore, the possibilities are having two A's, IA, IA, having an IA and just an I. Both of those people, because A is dominant over I by itself, which represents the O type, both of these will be type A. You could have IB, IB, or IB, I. Those type of people are both, both of those are type B. Because a type B person is a person that can make only type B antigens on the surface of the red blood cells. Similarly for A, only with type A antigens. All right. You could also have IA, IB, and that is a type AB person. Okay? This is an example in genetics of not only multiple alleles, because there's three alleles, not just two, but codominance. Usually you have complete dominance of one allele over the other. In codominance, they are equal in their dominance, and therefore they both exercise phenotypic expression, which means if you are a type AB person, you are just as much a type A person as a fully type A person, but at the same time, you're just as much type B as a fully type B person. So, with respect to red blood cells, that would mean a type AB person's blood cells have both the A antigen and the B antigen on them. They have both kinds of glycolipids on the surface of each blood cell. The only other possibility would be II, which is what a type O person will have. And therefore, a type O person won't make either kind of antigen on the red blood cells. Now, the red blood cells are part of the formed elements, of course. But what else do we have besides formed elements? What's the other major part of the blood? Well, what does formed elements mean? Formed elements are the cellular component of the blood. So all the blood cells plus the platelets combined make up the formed elements. Therefore, what's the rest of the blood? The plasma, right. And what do we know is in the plasma? Plasma proteins, right? Of all sorts that we've already talked about. Among those plasma proteins, though, are antibodies that are produced by certain white blood cells. Okay, all kinds of antibodies, millions of different kinds, not just millions of antibodies, millions of different kinds. We'll talk more about that in the immunity chapter. But of these antibodies, some that are produced are anti-A antibodies. Some of them are anti-B antibodies. The anti-A antibodies can recognize A antigens on the surface of red blood cells. And the anti-B can recognize B antigens. But the antibody is not a cell. The antibody is a protein in the plasma circulating around with the red blood cells. So hopefully it makes sense to you that a type A person whose red blood cells have the A type antigen on them will not produce anti-A antibodies. Otherwise, that person's blood or that person's antibodies would attack its own blood cells. So a type A person has type A antigens on the red blood cell and produces anti-B antibodies, so that if B blood is introduced into that body, it will be recognized as foreign blood by those anti-B antibodies. But there's no interference within that person's normal body between the anti-B antibodies and the A antigens that that type A person has, because B anti-B antibodies don't recognize A antigens. Exactly the converse for a type B. Type B antigens on the blood cells, and in the plasma, that type B person produces anti-A antibodies. Okay? Now, a type AB person produces both kinds of antigens, so that person better not make either kind of antibody, and it doesn't, and he doesn't, or she doesn't. Okay? A type O person doesn't make either kind of antigen. The red blood cells don't have A's or B's, and therefore, a type O person's plasma will have both anti-A and anti-B antibodies. And now this is the basis for the clinical ability or inability for people to donate to other people. So we often talk about a universal donor. Who is the universal donor? What type?
O
negative. Well, only in ABO. Let's not consider positive or negative because that's an RH group. But O, type O. You have to be very careful about that, though, because a type O person is not a universal donor of whole blood. A type O person is a universal donor only of red blood cells. Okay. Now, a type O person can give whole blood to another type O person. But let's say a type A person is the recipient getting the transfusion. If type O person gave whole blood to a type, if a type O person gave whole blood to a type A person, well, that would be bad, right? Because what is in the plasma of a type O person? Anti-A antibodies and anti-B antibodies. The anti-B antibodies wouldn't be a big deal for a type A person, but the anti-A's would. It would attack the blood cells. And that's why the O is not a universal donor of whole blood. You have to spin that blood down in the centrifuge, remove the plasma, and therefore remove the antibodies, and give just the red blood cells to anyone, because those red blood cells don't have any antigens, and therefore, they are not going to be attacked by the recipient's antibodies if it has any. Doesn't matter whether the recipient has no antibodies, anti-A antibodies, or anti-B antibodies. They're not going to affect O-type blood because it doesn't have any antigens. Does all that make sense? And now just the converse is true for type AB person. A type AB person is often called the universal recipient, right? Meaning they can receive from anyone. But once again, you have to be careful. It's universal recipient only of red blood cells. Since a type AB person has both kinds of antigens, doesn't matter what kind of blood cells come in, whether they have antigens or not, because an AB person doesn't have any antibodies against either type of antigen. So they're not going to be harmed when they come into that person's body. But if you gave the plasma from a type, any other type other than AB to an AB person, those antibodies that are in that plasma would attack the recipient's AB blood because it has both kinds of antibodies. So, once again, you have to centrifuge it down. Whole blood is not usually given unless there's a perfect match. So, that's what all of this is saying, and I'm not going to read this to you anymore. In 12, though, we can see a little cartoon of this happening. An antibody, one of these anti-A or anti-B antibodies that we're talking about, have multiple sites on them where they can actually recognize and bind to whatever antigen they're specific for. So if there is all of a sudden a type B red blood cell in a type A person's bloodstream, the anti-B antibodies of that person's plasma will recognize these foreign type B cells. And what happens is that there is going to be a binding between the antigen on the surface of the red blood cell and the antibody that's specific for it. That's what's happening right here. But there's multiple connection points. So a single green antibody, notice they're also called agglutinins, can hold together several red blood cells by their antigens. That's called agglutination, which is why they're called agglutinins. Agglutination sticks a bunch of foreign blood cells together. And that's what is the danger of it if you accidentally do this. All right. This is also, though, the basis for how you test a person's blood type. You take a little sample of a person's blood and you introduce it into a well that you know contains anti-A antibodies, another well that is anti-B antibodies, and you look for agglutination. If it doesn't happen, then you know that there aren't any antigens for that kind of antibody can recognize. Okay, that's ABO. In 13, we're looking at the RH group, which, as I said, is a totally independent blood group. But it's the other one that we really care about because it can cause medical problems. And usually it's medical problems having to do with pregnancy. Doesn't have to be, but that's usually the problem. Most people are RH positive. The RH got its name because it's short for rhesus monkeys, which is what these were discovered in. But anyway, it's not as complex as the ABO blood group to understand. You're either RH positive or RH negative, or at least the part of the RH blood group that we care about. That's the only. There's only one antigen involved that we care about, and you either have it or not, and therefore you either have the antibodies or you don't that recognize that antigen. Well, the danger comes in, and this used to be much bigger deal before they just developed a chemical solution for it, which is Rogam? Is that what they give pregnant women? I don't know anything about kids. I don't like them. But anyway, I remember in grade school, so this was before Rogam, one of my classmates' mother was RH negative, and so her daughter, which was my classmate, was the only kid she could have because of what happens here. If you have an RH negative woman, which is the rare type, because most people, like I said, are RH positive. If she's RH negative, but she is pregnant with a fetus that is RH positive, which is just a crapshoot, right? It's genetically determined, but it's more probable. It's three times as probable to be a RH positive as an RH negative. So if she is RH negative, chances are her fetus is RH positive. And if this is her first kid, it's usually not a big deal because there isn't supposed to be mixing of maternal and fetal blood. There sometimes is, though, at the end, even before birth, but especially at birth because things tear. And therefore, there's mixing of fetal and maternal blood. When that happens, if the fetus is RH positive, that RH positive blood, it's like a mini transfusion into the woman's own bloodstream. And she responds to this foreign antigen, the RH antigen, by producing antibodies against that RH antigen. Well, if this happens right at birth, the kid survives because it's not in time to do any damage. But now if she gets pregnant again, she's already going to have those antibodies in place, just like being immunized against something will will protect you against a further attack in the future. So, once again, there's not supposed to be mixing of blood, but for whole blood cells, but antibodies can get through the placenta. And so if she already made these antibodies, and she, as chance would have it, pregnant again would be another Rh positive fetus, then her antibodies would attack the blood of the fetus, and that can cause, what is it called, hemolytic disorder of the newborn or something like that. I forget what it's called. But what they do nowadays is just inject her with what it's Rogam, or that's a trade name, whatever it is. It just locks up her antibodies basically so that they won't have that effect. So it's a pretty simple solution nowadays. Anyway, that's why those are the two blood groups we really care about clinically. And therefore, when you say AB positive, that means in the ABO blood group, you're type AB. In the Rh blood group, you're positive. And all the other possibilities follow along the same lines. Okay, to 14 now. Now we're looking at a cell that is not an erythrocyte. This is the other major category of blood cell. What is that? This is a blood cell and it is not an erythrocyte. What is it? Definitely. Yeah, leukocyte is the most general term. That's what I was looking for. Which simply means white cell, right? Leuko means white. Well, even though there's a scale, size scale given here, leukocytes have quite a variety to them. So they can be anywhere from smaller than a red blood cell, depending on what type of leukocyte it is, to several times as big as a red blood cell. In the blood, they are fairly rare, like we already talked about when we looked at the buffy coat on a centrifuge tube, right? That very thin buffy coat is made up of all the white blood cells combined, and there's five types. And that's way overshadowed by that deep depth of red blood cells. So this is why if you look at a slide of human blood, you just take a drop of blood, put it on a microscope slide, and look at it, you'll see almost nothing but red blood cells. The vast majority of the cells you'll see will just be red circles, red blood cells. You might see one or two, maybe even more if you're lucky, but just one or two white blood cells of some type in this sea of erythrocytes. So they're rare in the blood, but that doesn't actually tell you how many there are in the body. Because white blood cells just don't spend very much time in the blood. White blood cells and red blood cells are both created by the same stem cells, right? Like we talked about. What are those stem cells called? So everyone is so satisfied with test one that you're going to wait again to the last night. They're called hemopoietic stem cells, right? Hemopoiesis is the creation of blood cells of any type. Okay, so anyway, when red blood cells get produced in hemopoiesis, in other words, when erythropoiesis occurs, those red blood cells take up residence in the bloodstream, and that's where they're going to live their life until they finally get destroyed, mostly in the spleen. White blood cells also start out in the marrow. Those white blood cells get put into the bloodstream, but they don't spend much time there. They get carried around for just hours usually, until they finally leave the bloodstream and take up residence in various lymphoid tissues, which we'll talk about in more detail when we get to the lymphatic system. But that's why if you just look at blood from the bloodstream, you don't actually see all that many white blood cells. There are many, many more white blood cells elsewhere. For every one that you see in the bloodstream, there's many. Now, they still don't come close to the numbers of red blood cells in the bloodstream or body, but there are many more than you would see just by looking at a blood smear. Anyway, this is just a leukocyte in general. We're not actually caring what kind it is yet. The main point here is that its major difference between this leukocyte and an erythrocyte is what? Other than spelling. Lysosomes is one difference, but lysosomes are examples of what? Organelles, right. You don't have organelles in red blood cells. We've already talked about losing the nucleus. Well, it's not just the nucleus. You lose the Golgi and the endoplasmic reticulum and the lysosomes so that it can be nothing but a bag of hemoglobin. White blood cells can't do that because white blood cells, because of their various functions, they need to continuously make proteins just like a normal cell would to do their various functions. So they have to have that machinery in them at all times. Okay, they have a totally different function from just carrying oxygen and carbon dioxide. And so that's why this looks more like a normal cell. You find things in it rather than just a... If you look at a microscope slide of blood, those biconcave discs just look like red circles with no detail at all in them. Because you can't, with a light microscope, you can't see the hemoglobin. Okay, well, I can start this. I probably run out of time, but we can start slide 15. Here we're looking at white blood cells in more detail. We're going to break... So white blood cells is, you know, that's part of the dichotomy. There are red blood cells, there are white blood cells, but there are several different kinds of white blood cells. Five major classes, and then in some cases those can be divided into several other subclasses. But... let me just rephrase that. White blood cells actually can be broken down into two major classes. There are five kinds of white blood cells we're going to talk about specifically, but those occur in two major categories of white blood cells. The first category of which are shown here. There's five overall white blood cells. Three of them are in one category, two of them are in the other category. The one that we're looking at here, the category that we're looking at here, is granulocytes. So all three pictures here are of granulocytes. Granulocytes is the general word named for the appearance of granules in these cells that can easily be viewed by light microscopy if you stain them correctly. Okay, so they're granular in appearance, the granulocytes. But that's a catch-all term for any one of these three. They specifically are called, as you see, neutrophils, eosinophils, and basophils. Now, basophils, eosinophils, and neutrophils, all three of those get their name not for what they do in the body, but for how they react to stains that you use in order to see them well under a microscope. So it has nothing to do with their natural function. Because these things don't look like this in the body, right? These are stained cells. A functioning, living leukocyte is going to be pretty much transparent. When you look at it under a slide, it's been stained. That's what makes it purple or whatever other color. So neutrophils get their name... Well, let me actually start with eosinophils. Eosinophils get their name because the dye that they take up most easily and get stained with is called eosin, a reddish dye. So eosinophils means they are eosin-loving, right? Eosinophilic, eosin-loving. Basophils, on the other hand, are so named because they take up methylene blue preferentially, which is a basic dye. But that leaves neutrophils, the third type of granulocyte, the one at the top. And neutrophils get their name because they don't really have a preference for the stain. They take them up about equally well. So they're neutral with respect to preference. And I probably should stop. Even though I do have 10 more seconds.